Welcome, Laura. Very good to see you and look forward to your talk. Thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me to visit you again. I'm really happy to be with you this evening. I thought it might be fun to take the train up from San Francisco. I live at the San Francisco Zen Center. And as Jim said, I've known Jim and Karen for many years and thought it'd be fun to take the train up and spend the night at their house. But other demands on my time have made that impossible. So I'm really grateful for this alternative. In the past, when I've met with you, I haven't talked much about my recovery from alcoholism, but I'd like to say a little bit about that now because it relates to what I'd like to share with you tonight. I started drinking when I was in high school, and right away, I loved the effects of alcohol. For one thing, it seemed to melt the painful boundaries between me and other people. But as my drinking progressed, I started to, looking back, I can see that I was manifesting some of the symptoms of alcoholism, which runs in my family, by the way. And those symptoms are craving. So when I started drinking, it was very hard to stop. Personality change. When I drank, I became another person. And the third thing was, blackouts. So I would wake up the next day and not know what I'd done the night before, which was really terrifying. And of course, maybe the overall symptom of alcoholism is to continue drinking despite negative consequences. Well, I drank for till I was in my early 20s, and I'm very lucky that I stumbled it into Zen Center when I was 25. And I stopped drinking abruptly, and I plunged into Zen practice. I loved the rigor and the discipline and the clarity of practice. It was really the opposite of the way I'd been living. And I'm very fortunate that I was able to live at Tassara Zen Mountain Center, Zen Center's monastery, in the midst of the Los Padres wilderness for several years. But, you know, when I left the monastery and came back into what we think of as the real world, alcohol started creeping back into my life, and it was no longer acceptable for me to drink that way. So I was constantly trying to stop and starting again, and trying to practice Zen. And it was what I think of as the double life of the alcoholic. And after 5 years of that suffering, I found myself sitting in a classroom at San Francisco State, where I'd gone to school as a younger person, and I'd gone back to school to get a teaching credential. And sitting in that classroom, I was sick and shaking from the night before, and I had a moment of clarity. I recognized that I could not stop drinking by myself, that I needed help. And I recognized that all those 7 day sessions and my monastic practice and the benefit of wonderful teachers. Also, by this time, I had a beautiful daughter. I did not want her to grow up with alcoholism. And so and the other thing I realized in that moment of clarity was I could name several Buddhist teachers who had harmed or destroyed their sanghas because of their addictive behavior, including a root teacher of mine at Zen Center. And so I got up out of that classroom, and I went and made a phone call. And the very next day I entered the rooms of recovery. That was September 28th, 1985. So I recently celebrated 38 years of sobriety. And I want to talk with you tonight. I'll be weaving in a little bit about alcoholism with this talk, because Jim mentioned my book, The Zen Way of Recovery. And this book is really a collection of essays about Buddhist teachings that have supported me in my recovery. And yet the very first words in my book are, Buddhism did not cure my alcoholism. You know, recently I ran into one of my former third graders who's now a young adult. And and it was like a message from my past that made me so grateful I was able to teach kids for 35 years without being under the influence of alcohol, that I've been able to be a mother and a good friend and to really plumb the depths of Buddhism with the clarity that comes with recovery. When we sit zazen, when we sit still, like we did this evening together, we sit in the middle of a crazy world. I know we all feel like it's crazier than it's ever been, but probably the world has always been just as crazy as it is now. We don't lean to the left nor the right. We don't lean forward or back, just sitting. And we watch what arises as we sit, not running away, not denying our existence, but returning again and again to the breath. And I often think of our breath as our best friend, since it's been there with us since the moment we were born. When we sit, we voluntarily embrace a certain limitation. Sitting still with a straight spine, we sit in a particular way. We choose when we sit not to do what we would usually do, sitting alone or with others. And within this limitation, we can taste a very real freedom from some of our afflictive emotions and behaviors. Since my book, The Zen Way of Recovery, came out, I've been speaking more openly about my recovery from alcoholism. And for me, alcohol is kind of a metaphor for our deeply human craving for things to be different than they are. The Buddha taught that the cause of our suffering is this craving or desire. And interestingly, in Sanskrit, the word craving is tanha, which can be translated as thirst. Now, maybe some of you are in recovery, but and many of you are not literally in recovery, but I do believe we're all in recovery from something. When I talk about alcohol tonight, I'd like to invite you to see alcohol as kind of a metaphor for something we all struggle with, whether or not we're literally in recovery, and that is confronting our self-defeating and self-destructive habits of mind and body. And I know that if you're sitting here tonight with us, you have experienced difficulty, suffering, in your life and in the lives of people you love. And maybe alcohol has touched the lives of people you love or your family members. So practice offers something precious to all of us, and it's the freedom of restraint. This is what I experienced when I first came to Zen practice after stopping drinking that first time, the freedom of restraint, the freedom of not being tossed around, driven and even destroyed by our insatiable craving to find something to fix us and make us feel better. So as I speak to you tonight, please let the word addiction be a kind of metaphor for the suffering of this kind of craving. For me, when I finally made the decision not to drink or use drugs and was able to stop completely, and I am one of those people that once I made that decision in the depths of my being, the craving for alcohol and drugs was completely lifted. I feel like that's because I started and stopped so many times before I proved to myself that I needed help. In recovery, we learn to pause and reflect before we mindlessly repeat the patterns of habitual self-destructive behavior that we've engaged in. We have the freedom to turn in a wholesome direction, to call a friend, to go to a meeting, to reach out to a power greater than ourselves. And as a Buddhist practitioner, that power for me is taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And I wasn't able to do that with true clarity and integrity till I did stop drinking. We vow to practice this pause, to turn again and again in a more wholesome direction, no matter what we're confronted with in life. And in recovery, we have this clarity to wholeheartedly take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. This is the alchemy. I think of this as the alchemy of recovery. Buddhist practice is also a kind of alchemy. Our practice of sitting quietly with ourselves and with others, coming back to the breath, seeing what arises within us, this practice of sitting still deepens our ability to respond to life in a more wholesome and appropriate way, rather than acting out those 108 delusions that Jim mentioned earlier. So I'd like to share with, I'm really pleased that we chanted the Hokkyo Zamai tonight. I'd like to share with you a chapter from my book called Erroneous Imaginations. And we chanted this beautiful phrase tonight. Well, I also like the phrase in the Hokkyo Zamai, practice secretly, working within, like a fool, like an idiot. That's a wonderful prescription for all of us. But the phrase that I'm thinking of is, when erroneous imaginations cease, the acquiescent mind realizes itself. When erroneous imaginations cease, the acquiescent mind realizes itself. And this is from the Hokkyo Zamai, the Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi by Tozan Ryokai, who was Dogen's teacher, by the way. The Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi tells us that when erroneous imaginations cease, the acquiescent mind realizes itself. For me, this means that when we loosen the grip of our self-created suffering, our flowing, flexible, big mind is able to shine forth. Now, perhaps our most pervasive erroneous imagination is, I am alone, a stranded individual in my own tiny little boat. Actually, we know really through science that we're deeply connected with all things and all beings. The air we breathe is given to us by the trees. The ground supports us. Without the sun, we wouldn't exist for a single moment. Each person we encounter becomes a part of our body through the five senses that literally bring one another within us through our five senses. And perhaps we would treat one another differently and would feel more at home in the world if we kept in mind the Buddha's notion that each person we meet was our mother in another lifetime. Although maybe that depends on how you happen to feel about your mother. An erroneous imagination that I carried with me for many years was the idea that I could drink like other people. I did drink like other people, but those other people happened to be alcoholics. So I could compare myself to them because many of them drank even more than I did. This erroneous imagination, this idea that somehow someday I could learn to control and enjoy drinking took me to very dark and dangerous places. In recovery, we say that even one drink is too many and 1,000 is not enough. I heard that phrase before I started drinking, and long before I stopped drinking, but when I really took it to heart that I was powerless over alcohol and its consequences, that's when my freedom as a human being began. There's an ancient curse, and this is often attributed to the Chinese, but it's more likely originated in England. May you live in interesting times. We are living in interesting times, navigating a global pandemic, witnessing the ravages of climate change, surrounded by rampant Orwellian doublespeak, experiencing the deep divisions and painful conflicts within our own society, maybe even within your own family. Around the world, there are mass migrations, ongoing wars. We think of the terrible tragedy unfolding in Israel and Palestine. shortages of clean water and air, people living in terrible poverty. And a startling example of our interconnection with one another is the way in which a pandemic can travel quickly around the world from being to being. This is a time of not knowing what's going to happen next, and this kind of uncertainty can draw us into a kind of constant state of unease. Our imaginations can lead us to fearful places. As I heard someone in a meeting, a recovery meeting, say once, my mind is a dangerous neighborhood. And I want to talk about fear tonight, because fear is often an erroneous imagination. When we fear the future, our imaginations can run away with us, conjuring up every possible worst case scenario. We can also fear the past in the form of regret, thinking that we can never undo the harm that we've done, that we've warped our lives. Fear that we've created problems in the past that we can't begin to unravel. We can create a whole reality about the future or the past and completely forget that we made it all up. We can forget to notice that not all the disasters we imagine come to pass. A tremendous amount of our energy and awareness can go into these kinds of imaginings. And when we're trapped in this fearful state of mind, we don't notice that we've abandoned the present moment. We can have the same this has been proven in science, that we can have the same physiological response to both imagined danger and real danger. Physiologically, we shut down when we're in fear. Our vision becomes narrow, our breath quick, our palms sweaty, and our choices limited. You know, we revert to that reptilian part of our brain that throws us into a state of fight or flight or freeze or flee. Fight or flight, freeze or faint. Those are those five F's. Fight or flight or freeze or faint. This is that reptilian brain that can take over. And when we're trapped in this fearful state of mind, we don't even notice that we've abandoned ourselves, really. Distracted by fear, we're no longer here. This morass tends to lessen the time, ability, and energy that we might have turned towards doing something to help the world and other people. I've heard people in recovery characterize fear as false evidence appearing real. False evidence appearing real, which is another way of citing erroneous imaginations. Now we can step back a bit and watch fear arise. This is something our practice offers us. We can watch fear arise just as we watch our breath. We can say, oh, there you are, my old friend, fear. And I have learned from studying what people can do when they have a panic attack is to look down and see and feel your feet on the ground. Look around the world and say to ourselves, right now, I'm okay. So practice enables us to cultivate this open, flexible, responsive mind, the mind of the Hokkyo Zamai. In the grip of fear, my practice teaches me to open to it, to breathe into it, to stay with it instead of running away. Now, we might feel some kind of guilt or shame about what we think of as negative emotions, but these emotions aren't always negative. And I think labeling them as negative just adds suffering to suffering. A fear can be an important protection from real danger, and anger can spur us to take action against injustice. Dogen Zenji, our great Soto Zen ancestor, says, settle the self on the self. That is, settle that small, frightened, self-concerned self on big self, on big mind. this deeper ground of being that we can sometimes glimpse in meditation or even at unexpected moments in our lives. I think of my moment of clarity in that San Francisco State classroom. Of course, Buddhism is full of lists. Buddhism was translated orally for about 400 years before his teachings were written down in Sri Lanka for the first time. And I think having the Buddhist teachings in the form of lists help people remember them and translate them orally. So the five fears in Buddhism are fear of loss of livelihood, fear of loss of reputation, fear of loss of life, fear of unusual states of mind, and interestingly, fear of speaking in front of an assembly. I'd have to add fear of getting stuck somewhere with nothing to read. That's one of my own fears. Most people have probably been subject to these fears at one time or another, and they're particularly vivid for those of us in recovery because our livelihood and our reputations, our very lives, were threatened by the rash and self-destructive actions we took when under the influence. The things that we did when we were in the grip of that reptilian state of mind, when our executive functioning was damaged by alcohol. Many of us spent years seeking unusual states of mind because we weren't comfortable with the ones we already had. We speak of having needed to take a drink or a few before a social event so that we could have the courage to talk to other people. When I was drinking, I lived constantly with a feeling of impending doom. And looking back, I know now what that feeling was. It was impending doom. The fear of what could happen when I was under the influence of alcohol. Fear is a gift if it motivates us to seek sobriety or to seek practice. One of the first Zen stories I heard was a story of the Buddha told. This is one of Buddha's wonderful parables. And I included this in a book for children that I wrote called Zen for Kids. A man is running across a field chased by a tiger. Holding onto a vine, he swings himself over the edge and he sees another tiger down below, licking his chops and waiting for him to fall. Just at that moment, a white mouse and a black mouse crawl out of a hole and start nibbling on the vine. He looks over and sees a strawberry growing close by. He grasps it, and how sweet it tastes. I see this as a metaphor for our life, fearful, tenuous, fraught with difficulty and suffering, ultimately fatal, and how very sweet as well. An antidote to erroneous imaginations, an antidote to paralyzing fear is to remember the preciousness of having been born a human being and to understand the nature of impermanence. You know, when David Chadwick, who wrote Suzuki Roshi's biography, Crooked Cucumber, when David Chadwick asked Suzuki Roshi if he could sum up Buddhism in just a few words, without skipping a beat, Suzuki Roshi said, "Everything changes." This simple and yet profound truth of impermanence. So appreciating the preciousness of human life. It's easy to escape, to appreciate our human life if we narrowly escape some accident or if we survive some traumatic event along with other people. I noticed this after 9/11 that people were much more generous and forgiving of one another after going through that together. In recovery, we find other people who have faced and survived a life-threatening disease. And we share a joyful relief and camaraderie that we don't necessarily find anywhere else. When we collectively go through a frightening episode, it can bring out the inherent heroism and generosity of human beings. People seem a little kinder, a little more gracious than usual, letting others into traffic, talking to strangers, smiling to strangers on the street. We slow down a bit because we deeply appreciate the preciousness and the revocability of human life. Through Buddhism, we realize that it is a great privilege to be born as a human being. We say in our service chant, this chance rarely occurs in any lifetime, this chance to practice. To be born into a human body rather than, say, to be born a piece of moss on a rock, you know, this is a privilege we shouldn't take for granted. Hakuin Zenji, who lived from 1686 to 1769, he was apparently quite a wild man, and there's a lot of great stories about the poet and wild monk Hakuin Zenji, our great Zen ancestor. He said, having been born into this world as a human being, having had the good fortune not only to have been born into this world as a human being, but also to have encountered the teaching of the great Shakyamuni Buddha, how can we help but be overjoyed? Now, during the everyday chores of life or in times of sickness or hardship, we can slip into negativity or self-pity and forget that we only have these problems because we've had the good fortune to have been born into a human body. If we were a piece of moss on a rock, we wouldn't have to take out the garbage or pay taxes. We wouldn't be subject to fear or anger or resentment or envy. But as far as I know, we also wouldn't be able to appreciate a sunset or fall in love. Thich Nhat Hanh speaks about awakening to each moment by taking care of each thing as it arises. He talks about washing a dish as if we were washing a newborn baby, or tearing lettuce as if we were touching a flower. If we approach our everyday activities in this way, we awaken to the unique beauty of each moment and remember how precious it is just to be born a human being. We can give ourselves a break from obsessive worry if we just come back to the present moment and take a deep breath and savor it. You know, sometimes in my teaching, people say, I don't have time to meditate every day. And I say, you know, we always have time to take three deep breaths. Thich Nhat Hanh spoke about being in Montreal, a French-speaking country, and the license plates say in French, I think it's je reviens, I remember. And he would say, when you see that license plate, just to remember how precious it is to be a human being, and remember to take and enjoy a deep breath. And I think it's really a helpful practice to think of something that will remind you to take three deep breaths. Maybe when you hear a siren, or you have time to take three deep breaths when you hear your phone ring, or when you're stopped at a stop sign or a stoplight. Recovery grants us the clarity and subtlety to be available for everyday life and to take joy in simple pleasures. You know, those of us in recovery, when we were using, were used to these big ups and downs and the drama of using drugs or alcohol, or there are plenty of addictive behaviors as well. Rather than seeking extremity and taking risks, we can enjoy ordinary activities like watching a hummingbird come to the hummingbird feeder, smiling at a stranger on the street, or seeing a tree in blossom. We can find satisfaction in what's right in front of us. And we can also marshal our talents, our intelligence, and our abilities to serve the world. Suzuki Roshi said very wisely, don't try to take on the whole world. Find something you can devote yourself to and do it completely. And he called this, he said, shine one corner of the world in his beautiful poetic way. Another reminder is understanding impermanence. One of our erroneous imaginations is mistaking the impermanent for the permanent. Zazen is literally practice for understanding impermanence. As I watch my breath come and go, as I watch feelings and thoughts come and go, I can see that even a difficult emotion like fear is not solid or never ending. Each moment arises and passes away, as do all things. And if I can surrender to this moment, rather than living always in the past or the future, I can be more fully alive, and I can be more fully myself. We want to be present for this moment because this is life, life itself. And this is easy to believe and easy to say, but not always easy to do. And that's why we call it practice. Zazen can jog us out of our old ways of being, our old ways of thinking, our old behaviors that don't serve us anymore. And if we do practice sitting down regularly and following our breath, watching what arises, we're much more likely to carry this practice into our everyday life. We're more likely to notice when we're in the grip of erroneous imaginations. Zazen helps us cultivate what Suzuki Roshi in his Zen classic, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, what he characterized as beginner's mind, which is open to many possibilities. I can draw a wider circle of compassion that includes myself and others, rather than being trapped in a narrow, selfish state of fear or hatred. If we live in fear today, that will also affect our future because we're literally missing out on our life and on the possibilities and potentialities that await us. In a real way, our actions today even affect our past because one way to make positive use of our remorse is to put our own preoccupations aside and help others. We do this every day in recovery, reaching out a hand to another suffering person. We tell our story of recovery so that other people can identify with it and realize that they too can step onto this path. We find that the things that we did that we were ashamed of when shared with another person can help them identify with our story and recognize that recovery is possible, even for the most damaged and destitute. This is a great message of hope, really, for the whole world. Brother David Stendelrost is a lovely Benedictine monk that I was able to spend time with at Tassajara. He told me that if Jesus Christ was alive today, he would be down in the basement with the alcoholics. I really love him saying that. In recovery, because a lot of AA meetings happen in the basement of churches. In recovery, our fear of economic insecurity is healed by becoming more employable, by taking better care of our finances, by avoiding unnecessary spending, by paying parking tickets when they happen instead of waiting for them to mount up, and by saving for the future. Our fear of people begins to dissipate when we take responsibility for ourselves, when we tell our story, when we engage in service and work with others. In recovery, I learned to live and let live. In recovery, I sat with a diverse group of people that I might never have known otherwise. I learned things from a person who was homeless that I could have never learned anywhere else in my life. Sitting in a meeting, I don't get up and leave a meeting because someone says something I don't like. I get there a little early and I stay after to offer fellowship to others. I stay in the meeting, stay with my feelings, stay with my fear and discomfort, knowing that they will dissipate, as well as any craving that might take hold of me. So any craving for unwholesome behavior will pass. And you know what? This is a admonition that Pema Chodron makes. She talks about this in, I think it's When Things Fall Apart, to just stay with whatever's arising rather than fleeing. So I'd like to invite you to just take a few deep breaths and sit quietly for a moment. At the end of each chapter in my book, and by the way, I'm really pleased to hear from people who aren't in recovery, who are still finding some fresh wisdom in these Buddhist teachings that I've offered that have helped me in my life. Even my brother-in-law, with whom I don't always get along, has enjoyed reading my book. So that was a major coup. So I'd like you to sit quietly and take a few deep breaths, and then I'd like to offer some reflections or some practices for you as we sit in our Zazen posture. We sit quietly in our Zazen posture, coming back to our breath. When fear does arise in our life, we can reflect on these questions. Is this a reasonable fear, one I should listen to? With the clarity of practice, I'm better able to assess a situation and respond appropriately. I can ask myself, is my imagination working overtime, conjuring up dreadful possibilities that may never come to pass? Am I too hungry, angry, lonely, or tired? And is this affecting my thinking? Those words spell out the initials HALT or HALT. When we're too hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. Am I telling myself things that aren't true? Like, no one cares about me, I've ruined my life forever, nothing good will ever happen for me. I can ask myself, is the fear I'm holding on to now actually some learned fear from the past that I'm ready to discard? Am I applying an old fear to a completely new situation? If I'm afraid of financial insecurity, are there steps I can take in the present that may help my future situation? If you find yourself spiraling into fear, anxiety, and negativity, you might bring to mind this precious phrase from the Hokkyo Zamai: when erroneous imaginations cease, the acquiescent mind realizes itself. I'd like to thank you for your kind attention. And we do have time for discussion, questions and answers, or sharing your own experience with the group around these themes. I hope that something I've said might have given rise to something you might like to share with the group. And Jim, I'm not sure how you negotiate that. Maybe you could help me with that.
We have a microphone here in the room, and people, when they want to speak, they'll raise their hand, and the person who has the microphone will give it to that person. So I have the microphone now, and I'd like to say something.
Thank you, Jim. And can I also just say thank you so much for those of you who are with us on Zoom. And if you have a question or comment, please share it in the chat. So, Jim, thank you for speaking up.
You're welcome. And I really appreciated your talk, and particularly the thing you said toward the end about staying in the room. And that seems to me to be what I kept thinking about was, you know, all of us, alcoholic or not, we all want the pleasant and we all want to avoid the unpleasant. And, this is because we're sentient beings. And it just, what I kept thinking through your talk was, and so the point of practice is to one of the points anyway, is to teach us patience mm-hmm. with the unpleasant. And so, you know, the practice of staying with the room, if you stay in the room, you don't really know whether you're going to get the pleasant or you're going to get the unpleasant, but your practice is staying in the room. And thank you for that practice, because I think that's an important one. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Jim. Yes, we've all had the experience in a long meditation of waiting, just waiting for that bell to ring. But we don't get up and run out of the zendo, do we? We stay with whatever's arising. Yes, thank you for that, Jim.
The mic is open. Also, people on Zoom can raise their hand and be recognized. There's no recovering. There seem to be no people in recovery in this room. No, there's a hand.
My hand. Thank you so much. I really appreciated how in depth you went into fear. Mm-hmm. It's just something I've been feeling and noticing in myself, especially now with so much horrific polarization and conflict and war and violence and horror. And I find that if I'm talking to somebody and they will say some kind of extreme statement about, well, you know, if this happens and this happens, then this is going to happen. Mm-hmm. And the statement itself makes me more afraid. And so I guess what I've been trying to work on is noticing how we say things.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
That a lot of our statements are formed from fear, and that they're extreme and they're already closing in possibilities, like you said earlier. Mm-hmm. And that's what's scary to me, actually. In terms of war, it's like closing in possibilities is very, very scary. So just aware of how we express the language that we use and how we can make extreme statements. That's just what I wanted to say. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for that, for bringing in this other element, because fear doesn't just happen within us. It can be fomented by others, and we see this happening. We see people deliberately trying to make people afraid of one another. And it, you know, it's a good reminder that we don't sit zazen, we don't practice the way just for ourselves. You know, we practice so that we can be a light in the darkness, and so that whatever whatever peace and awareness we can cultivate is of benefit to all beings. And by the same token, one of the reasons I found it so helpful to recover with other people was because it would remind me that I don't just recover for myself. I that would be a very selfish and very limited type of recovery. It's manifold. It becomes manifold when it's shared with other people. This is something for me that recovery and practice have in common, that we don't do it for ourselves. We do both of these things, practice and recovery, and they overlap beautifully to be a benefit to all beings. I think the recovery path is definitely the bodhisattva path, where we vow to live and be lived for the benefit of all beings, not just for ourselves, not just for our family, not just to heal the ancient twisted karma in our family life, but in our human family as well. So thank you for bringing in that interrelatedness of fear. Yeah. Matthew.
Thank you for your response.
Matthew, can we hear?
Hi, yes.
Hi.
There you are.
Hey. Hi, Laura. Hey, thank you so much for those words. I don't know where to start here. So it's kind of interesting that while we're reading the Song of the Jewel Samadhi, I saw that line, practice secretly working within. I'm like, oh, that's so good. I'm going to like write that down and type it out and put it on my desk. But then you brought up the when erroneous imagination ceases, the acquiescent mind realizes itself. And I'm like, well, wait, that's really good too. So I'll put that at the top and I'll have these two quotes together. And so, you know, I have this sitting in front of me right now. And but that's not what I want to talk about. Well, I want to come back to that. But when you were talking about practice and, you know, just seeing people on the streets and, you know, spending time with them, I don't have a hard time with that so much. That's easy. If such a thing is easy, that's easy for me. But sitting after the service, that's difficult. That right now, even now, it's like I'm starting to hyperventilate. That's something that I'm the person who wants to be the first person like out the room in my car. You know, I'll even park my car in, you know, back first so that I can just get out of that parking lot like right away. And I'm looking at and I never thought about it as practice. I never thought about staying in the room as a form of practice. And yet looking at those two lines, or those two quotes together, the practicing secretly is what I'm just kind of getting. This is what's actually going to remove those erroneous imaginations. I can't do it without that. I can't just sit here by force of will and get rid of those imaginations. It's through this secret practice that it happens. So thank you so much for bringing that to my attention.
Well, thank you, Matthew. Yeah. You know, we also chant, beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Well, that's impossible, right? But just by showing up tonight, you are doing service. You are manifesting the way. I think we can underestimate the profundity of not only staying, but just showing up in the first place for one another. Not just for ourselves, not just for our own awakening, but to encourage other people. You know, it would be very hard to sit sesshin all by yourself. I know some people do that, but to sit sesshin or even to sit a period of zazen with a person sitting on your right and your left is a very different experience. And I'm so sorry that COVID interrupted that for us for quite a while. Although Zoom is really a great thing. It's a great alternative that we stumbled on pretty quickly. Yeah. Thank you, Matthew.
Thank you.
Someone else?
Hi. This week is finals week over at Sac State. And, you know, been busy with finals and whatnot. And so a few hours ago before today's sit, I was doing a final and I was cutting a bit close because I wanted to show up today. And then I realized, oh my God, I'm going to be late. So I figured I just won't go. And then it turned out, oh, okay. I guess the circumstances happen, so I will go. I will go. I'll be a little bit late. Jim will forgive me. So I showed up. It was nice. The talk was very nice, and I appreciated your comment about just showing up and being in the room. So thanks. That's all.
Thank you for being in the room. I wonder if anyone would be willing to maybe share your own experience of fear or of an erroneous imagination. You know, in the course of your life, you might have noticed something that you believed that you realized you don't believe that anymore, and that your practice has shown you another opening, another truth.
Hi, I think I've gone through a lifetime of that. Being raised a Christian and abandoning that, not because of Jesus, but because of the church. Growing my hair long and hitchhiking all over the country, smoking dope all the time, dropping acid whenever available, pretending I was a poet, and that dropping away, householder, killer commute, killer hours for decades. And now at a point in my life, kind of, we talking about this last week, just kind of basking in self-care. There's sometimes I think there's been different people inhabiting this body that continually changes, being followed around by one string of memories and the results of actions.
I've been reading Stephen Batchelor and his book, Buddhism Without Beliefs. And one thing he says is that we can practice Buddhism and find, the Buddha encouraged us to use this as an experiment and to find our own truth, to find out through our own experience what our truth is. And he gives the example of reincarnation and Suzuki Roshi wouldn't talk about reincarnation. Actually, he used the metaphor that of a waterfall. The water that approaches a waterfall is all of a body. And then when it goes over the falls, it becomes individual drops. And then when it reaches the bottom, it again joins a pool of water. He used that as a metaphor for reincarnation. But, you know, as you're speaking, what you just shared with the group, I think most of us can look back on our lives and see that we've lived many lives within this lifetime. The life with our family, you know, we all had to leave home the way the Buddha did and question the beliefs that we'd been offered, that we'd grown up with, that we'd taken for granted. And so for me, this is a kind of reincarnation that we, and it's one of the great gifts of impermanence, that we can change, that we can grow, that we can go in another direction in our lives. So I think each of us manifests many different lifetimes within this lifetime. You know, I tell the story that one day a couple of my third graders were walking behind me in the hall. I don't know why they were talking about death, but Talia said to Tess, "Hey, Tess, would you rather be buried or cremated?" And Tess, without skipping a beat, said, "I don't know, surprise me." And, you know, that's kind of how I feel about reincarnation. I don't know, surprise me. I learned a lot. I learned a lot from my third graders. And, you know, I don't think we have to abandon the lives that we lived in order to get to the life we're living now, because we couldn't have gotten here without those, let's say, previous incarnations that we went through, to find ourselves all sitting in this, in one way or another, in this beautiful Zendo with one another. Are there any last thoughts you'd like to share before we close this evening?
Hi, Laura, this is Karen.
Hi, Karen.
thank you so much for your talk. Just one thing I was thinking about, someone long ago at Zen Center was saying that, people who become alcoholics have a loss of faith. I mean, that loss of faith is involved. And I just wondered, well, I guess it seemed like what you did with your recovery is that you had simultaneous kind of, I mean, you were practicing, I don't know if it was, you'd call it faith, but you were practicing Buddhism at the same time. Anyway, just if you'd like to comment on that.
Yeah, Karen, I would, because those of us in recovery find it really fruitless to figure out why we're alcoholic. You know, we're alcoholic because it's sort of fruitless to try to figure out why. Of course, there's a genetic component. They've figured this out with twin studies that alcoholism is something that can be genetically predetermined. It's also a response to trauma. Many people who use alcohol or drugs experience trauma in their lives, and they're self-medicating with alcohol or drugs. I don't really identify with that idea of a loss of faith. I feel like alcoholism actually makes you lose your faith. It makes you sink into a kind of negative state of being. Alcoholism lures you in because at first it's this ecstatic yes to life. It's a wonderful, exuberant, new lease on life that you get. And it's a delusion. It's an erroneous imagination because over time that expansiveness becomes contracted into a very stagnant pool of self. That's when you've lost your faith, you know, and it's a wonderful thing that mysteriously, not for everybody, not everybody gets a hold of recovery, but for many people, they can abruptly make a turn in the road that they wouldn't have naturally made. And that happens for many, many different reasons. Sometimes it's just seeing the example of another sober alcoholic that helps give them faith that there is another way of life. So I hope that might answer your question to some extent.
Yeah, it does. Thank you. I look forward to reading your book too.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I'd love to know that you're reading it, Karen. Our friendship goes back a long way.